You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon at webcomicbeacon.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Webcomic Beacon here at webcomicbeacon.com, part of the Webcast Beacon Network at webcastbeacon.com, and we are hosted by the Hiveworks Comic Collective at thehiveworks.com, as of also as which, if that is poor grammar, but they are also sponsoring this particular episode, so go ahead to check out thehiveworks.com. Check out all the awesome comics that are there. I'm Fess of ArgerComic.com, and with me I have Mark Savory of AutumnLake.com.
Well, hello there.
And Kelly Turnbull of ThePunchlineIsMachismo.com.
Hello.
Otherwise, manly guys doing manly things. And this particular episode, we have Mark Wade from MarkWade.com and ThrillBent.com. It is ThrillBent.com. Yes, it is. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir.
And let's see, we were just talking earlier about the, I'm starting to get a whole lot of snow. Are you getting a lot of snow where you're from?
Not a bit. Not actually. Well, when you say where I'm from, actually, that's where it gets a little tricky because I'm shuttling back and forth between visiting in California and living in Indiana, of all places. So, and yet, no snow either place, although it's clearly I'm more likely to get it in Indiana. And when it happens, it will paralyze the city.
It would probably, if it ever did snow in California, it would probably paralyze that city as well, because they probably have no idea what to do with it.
Dude, a quarter inch of rain paralyzes this city.
Jeez. Anyway, enough about the weather. We are here with, now, if my sources are correct, three-time Eisner Award nominated, and out of one of those, actually a winner in 2012.
Finally.
Yes.
At long last, finally.
Steven Spielberg.
Yeah. Daredevil number 7 from the 2011 run or something like that, right?
Yeah. Finally.
Finally.
Yes. We cleaned up this year at the Eisners and at the Harvey Awards, and I couldn't be happier. It's kind of nice to, after 25 years in the business, to finally win an award. It's kind of a good feeling.
Yeah, and you know, I could go on for quite a while over your career and in the backlog of characters that you've written for: Superman, The Flash, Spider-Man, Batman, Avengers, Captain America, Booster Gold, Fantastic Four, Legion of Superheroes. And of course, Daredevil. I mean, that is just but a handful of what you've been working on.
Yeah, that's just a tiny bit of the iceberg. Exactly.
And you see here, I'm using the resource Comic Book DB or Comic Book Database to try to figure out everything that you're doing. And not quite honestly, the list is very varied. For one, I mean, you got Marvel and DC in there. But, I mean, you got a couple of stuff that I've never heard of before and some Walt Disney stuff, Warhammer video game comics.
I actually edited those, but still, yes, I've been all over the map between being an editor and being a writer and being a publisher and being, this and that and everything in the industry. I don't think there's many of the characters or franchises that I haven't had something to do with at some time or another, from Archie Comics all the way down to, The Incredibles, to Warhammer, to the Disney stuff, to, pretty much everything.
And so out of your vast catalog, what were some of your most favorite experiences?
Well, I would have to say, let's see. All right. So having an 8-year run on The Flash was a good experience, because not only was I working with some really great artists, including the late lamented Michael Ringo, who was a great friend and a terrific artist, but it was a good sort of training ground for my career, because it was fairly early on and I was, given 8 years of kind of hands-off editorial treatment, just sort of do what you feel is best and get in there and do what you want. And that, helped me work out a lot of the kinks in the system. But and then other highlights include my run on Fantastic Four with Mike, Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, depending upon any given day, my favorite thing I ever wrote would be Superman Birthright, which was a 12-issue miniseries that just been turned into a trade paperback since by DC Comics, which is sort of my love letter to Superman, if you will. Mm. My big sort of, here's why I like Superman, and this is why I don't think he's boring, and this is why I think you should like him too. And what is most pleasing to me about that is that I love Superman above all else. I just like, that's the thing that I just, my entire life revolves around Superman and, you know, eating like a 5-year-old. So the idea that I was finally able to come out and just say, look, here's everything I love about this character, and here's all the reasons that I think you should like it too. What I like about this is that everybody who comes up to me with it to get it signed at a convention, or everybody who talks to me about having read it, most of them are people who didn't like Superman before they went into the book and came away saying, man, I really like this character now. And that's what made that really worth telling. And that means I did it right. That feels good.
Very cool. And I gotta go back a little bit and ask about the Flash run. Now, you said that was early in your career. What did you do to get DC Comics to I guess give you as much freedom as they did for the Flash? Like,
I just got lucky. My best friend at the time was also the editor. That helped a lot. And Brian Augustin and I were just simpatico on so many levels, and we understood the same kind of stories, and we liked the same kind of stories. And, you know, every month it was me getting on the phone with Brian and, you know, shooting the breeze for, you know, an hour or two. I mean, we'd talk every day, but I mean, we'd sit down and we'd talk, okay, let's talk about Flash today. And we would talk about Flash, and we'd block out a story, and then I would go write it up, and he might change a comma here or there, but he basically left me alone, which was, you know, a pretty awesome experience. he trusted me at a time when everybody else at DC Comics didn't want me to be there. Everybody at the company just thought, oh, he's just another fanboy turned pro, and he's going to write, you know, fan service comics, and it's going to be just a bunch of continuity porn, and it's going to be awful, and cancel this after 6 issues. And Brian got the last laugh.
I can't think of anybody that. No, the way you said that makes me think that if you're supposed to be a professional, that they're not fans. Then, to me, that.
It's a weird, sad sort of self-loathing that happens in the industry, where it's, you know, where people are so defensive about not wanting to look like they're enormous fans of the material, because then it becomes too inside baseball. They're afraid that, you know, the fear is that if you let people write the characters who are come too much from fandom, that they will write just for other fans and not for a broader audience. And to some degree, that, you know, that is not an untrue assumption. But, and certainly, you know, over the years, people have proven that out. But you can do both. You can totally do both. You can totally be a huge fan of the character and still be able to write for a broader audience who doesn't know everything about the character that you do. It's apparently it's harder than I think it is, because I think it's easy, and I apparently it's not. Looking at some of the other comics out there, apparently it's not as easy as I think it is.
Well, I think back to the DC comics I used to buy, like All-Star Squadron comes to mind, Roy Thomas's writer. Yeah. He was obviously a super fan of those Golden Age characters.
Yeah,
seemed to make it work for a while.
Because Roy, you know, Roy had experience with writing for a broader audience. There is something in no way do I want to suggest that people who are fans of the characters or are in love with these characters shouldn't be able to write them. I mean, one of the things I loved about Roy's books, even near the sort of the end of his run with Infinity Inc. and Young All-Stars and stuff, where it was they began to be very, very much about continuity points and not as much about story. Even then, I was enjoying them. I was, as a reader, and as I was the assistant editor on those books for the last couple of years. And I turned to Dick Giordano once, who was the editor in chief at DC at the time, and a great, great man. And I turned to him and I said, why do I enjoy these books as much as I do? I was genuinely serious. Like, I don't, because they were everything we didn't want to publish at that point. They were not well drawn. They were so deep in their own continuity that they really were sort of impenetrable for new readers. I said, why do I enjoy these comics so much? And Dick said something to me I've never forgotten. He says, because Roy would write them for free and it shows on the page. And I'm like, you know what? That's a really good reason. There's that X factor that you can't fake, you know, that the enthusiasm, the love and enthusiasm for these characters shines through all of this sort of obfuscating, again, inside baseball sort of feel to it. And you get that, you know, that came through. So you can still do that with you. I mean, you know, Phil Jimenez has handled Wonder Woman over the years, and Phil's stuff is not the easiest read in the world. I mean, Phil's a great guy and a great writer and a terrific artist, but it's very, he tends to focus very much from my point of view on stuff that is a little minutia oriented. And that sounds, you know, that sounds like a terrible insult. I don't mean that to be, because I love Phil to death. And I like his work, but I think that, but this is what I'm saying is that because Phil loves the character so much, it shows in his work, and that helps trump any problems that new or outside readers might have accessing the material.
Hmm. So you were partially responsible for Elseworlds, right? Like that.
Yeah,
I always try to like don't, because I'm like, I might be getting people's names wrong, and I don't want to like horribly offend.
No. Again, Brian Augustin and I, you know, we were thick as thieves, and I was the editor when I was at DC. I was the editor of a book called Secret Origins, which is our sort of anthology book.
I remember that so well.
I was very fond of that book, and we had to do an annual one year, a big 80-page annual, and I was trying to come up with ideas for it, that ways of doing, you know, justifying an 80-page annual that used characters that we hadn't seen before. But the problem is we'd already burned off Superman and Batman and some of the other characters earlier in the run. So I remember on the way home from work that day, it suddenly hit me. I said, let's do four 20-page imaginary stories, if you will. Let's do four 20-page hypothetical what if stories of what if Superman. I specifically remember thinking, this is 1988. I specifically remember thinking, what if Superman landed in Russia instead of Kansas? That was 1988. What if, what if Batman happened 100 years earlier? What if Wonder Woman, I can't remember what my Wonder Woman one was. And then the Flash, and then I just said Flash, but nobody cared about the Flash. I couldn't figure out a good book for the Flash. Anyway, so I call up Brian. As soon as I get home, I call up Brian, and I start just gassing on about this idea. And Brian seizes on the Batman angle. And before I know it, he comes in the next day to the office, and he's got half the thing plotted out in his head. And we sat in my office, and we jammed on the rest of it, although it was 99% Brian. And as luck would have it, Mike Mignola was walking the halls at that point. It was right after or right during the end of Cosmic Odyssey or right after it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'd known Mike for a while, and I knew Mike was a big fan of the Jack the Ripper material in general. And of that period, he'd be perfect for this. So we seized on Mike and we caught him on a good day. He was literally in the halls. If Mike had not been in the halls that day, we wouldn't have Gotham by Gaslight, and we wouldn't have Elseworlds, and we wouldn't have all that stuff, because it was just a confluence of people being in the right place at the right time. So once we had Mike on board, I thought, well, this is, you know, let's not do this as a 20-page story. This deserves to be something bigger and grander on its own. And I sold Dick Giordano on the idea of doing it as a one-shot, which became Batman Gotham by Gaslight. Mm-hmm. And we were off to the races, and that begat the Elseworlds line. I brought in the next one, which was Batman Holy Terror by Alan Brennert and Norm Brayfogle. I brought that into the company, and then had left the company by the time it was published, but still that was kind of my baby too. So we had Elseworlds, and that was kind of neat, except I guess 5 years later or so, Brian and I are standing at a Toys R Us looking for stuff for his kid, and we look at the Batman action figure aisle, and their giant Elseworlds line of action figures. Look, there's Caveman Batman and Cowboy Batman and Sneeze Guard Batman and you know, Exact Change Batman. And we looked at each other like, oh my God, this is on us. You know, what have we done? What have we wrought?
I don't know. Like I was just wondering if it was like a hard sell to like convince DC to do it, because like that, I mean, like you were saying, like there's everybody's so kind of like wrapped up in continuity. And I'm one of those people who kind of wishes that, like, you know, you would get a writer to like do sort of a self-contained run, and then like the next person could go on and do their own
because it's the most frustrating thing
when you know, like, a writer does something that is amazing and you love it and you're just like, oh, this is what this character should be, and then the next person comes on and just kind of like wizards everything away, and
you
know, Spider-Man isn't married anymore and right. and all that.
I'm with you, but it wasn't hard to sell, because as I say, when you have Mike Mignola as your ace in the hole, it becomes a much easier sale.
Especially when you got that, oh no, this is absolutely stepped out. Look at how far removed from this. Nobody will be confused because of the setting, that sort of thing. And the Superman one, was that Red Sun? Is that what it was called?
It ended up being, I mean, I you know, Mark Millar years later came, you know, had hit upon the same basic idea, which is, what if Superman had landed in Russia? Uh-huh. And he turned that into Red Sun. There have been some good Elseworlds out there, but there for every good near the end of the run, by the, you know, but for every good Elseworlds out there, there were 14 really lame ones. You know, what if, you know, what if Batman fought during the Crimean War? I don't care.
You know? Weren't there old like What If comics? Like,
I think that's Marvel, right?
Yeah, that's a Marvel thing. Is that okay. But before that, it was begat by. And the whole concept was begat by Jerry Siegel, who did the first of these imaginary stories. They call them in the 60s. Not as if all stories aren't imaginary, but as if Superman the regular comic was a documentary. But the idea was that, okay, well, let's do something that is purely out of continuity, and let's do a series of stories that we will call imaginary stories. And they're, what, you know, what if Superman married Lois Lane? What would that be like? Or what if Supergirl came to Earth before Superman? Or, you know, again, they did hundreds of these.
I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see that come back. I mean, then again, Marvel kind of does that, and then they just go with it. It's like, we already have Spider-Man. Well, this one's going to be uncanny. This one's going to be uncanny. This one's going to be avenging. This one's going to be ultimate. This one's, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, whatever. So, like, with your experiences as an editor, which is about a little less than a third of what you've written, what did you enjoy doing more, being a writer or being an editor?
Being an editor by a long shot. I mean, you don't have to finish the question. I being a writer is hard, man. Being a writer is really hard, and being an editor is hard too. But it's a different set of muscles. Being a writer is being, you know, it's just you and a keyboard, and you know, you fail or succeed on your own. But it's even though it's a collaborative process, because you're working with artists and you're working with other writers and you're working with editors, still at the end of the day, it's you at a keyboard at 2 o'clock in the morning. Whereas editorially, it's a little more collaborative. It's a little more sort of, you know, not only just herding sheep and doing the clerical stuff, but the fun part of it is the, you know, the jamming with other writers, the jamming with other artists, the throwing back and forth of ideas, the imagination that sparked out of it.
Yeah, I mean, but the writers do that too, don't they? I mean, you just mentioned that part.
Yeah,
I feel like people like say they doubt how useful an editor is, I just say, like, you know, it's editing is the difference between like Game of Thrones and Dances with Dragons. Like that's how important editors are.
Yeah, a good editor makes everything much, much better, because they know exactly, you know, basically they're like, you know, sound engineer board guys who know exactly how to hit all the levels so that, you know, and how to mark all the levels so that nothing feels overproduced or nobody is, you know, no single part of the process feels like it's overwhelming the rest.
And with that, seeing both sides here, I'm assuming this gives you a better insight and understanding of when you're a writer and you're dealing with an editor, or if you're an editor dealing with a writer, that you can actually see both sides of the coin.
Yeah. And I think that has it, that may, as much as anything, sort of help explain the weirdness of the fact that I have had a career in comics much longer than anybody has a right to have a career in comics. is that I having worked both sides of the desk and being empathetic to both sides of the desk, you know, I get it. I know that, you know, I know the responsibilities upon me as the writer to provide the rest of the food chain with work, to be able to, you know, to not keep my editors insane, to not, you know, to hit deadlines, or at least, you know, if I don't hit every deadline, at least I can work with you with the editor to make sure that you're not, I'm not screwing things up too bad. Mm-hmm. That sort of being able to understand all the way the process works. And that means I'm also not throwing curveballs to my editors right and left too, trying to get, throwing problems at them that I don't know how to solve, because I know how to solve the problem. So I think that helps enormously. It's something certainly as an editor I appreciate as well. I appreciate working with writers who get what it's like to be on my side of the desk as an editor and know that it's not, as I'm very fond of saying, when I'm writing something, it's my story, but the moment I hand it off to an editor or an artist or whatever, it's no longer my story. It's our story. It's a collaborative medium. Everybody has things to say about it. Everybody gets to have a voice in the story. It's going to be at its strongest when everybody does have a voice in the story. And I need, as an editor, I like working with writers who get that, who understand that it's not, I need you to be protective of your work. I need you to have pride in your work and to feel a sense of ownership to your work. But at the same time,
it's a group effort.
It's a group effort. Yeah.
I got a couple of hot seat questions for you.
No, hit me. Okay.
All right. With the insight of the dynamics of a writer-editor relationship, who really has the power in the direction of how a storyline will progress?
Wow, that's a good question. As a general rule, the editor. On the other hand, if I were, you know, if I were some brand new editor 6 months into the industry and Brian Bendis was doing something for me, you know, I think that my answer might be different. Or J. Michael Straczynski or somebody like that. There's part of being an editor too is letting everybody feel like they've got the amount of control that they need to have to do the job right.
Okay.
If that makes any sense. So it's hard. I mean, if you're dealing with egos, if you're dealing with, and I'm not saying those guys have egos. Well, I'm not saying Brian Bendis has an ego, but the other guy. But if you're dealing with egos, then you have to massage that too. It's at the end of the day, whoever writes the check, you know, whoever signs the check is the guy who has the power and whoever gets to control the way things are going. But if you're a smart editor, you work it so that everybody feels like they're working with you, not working for you.
And with that comes the next question. And would you say that the correct people get the blame or praise for the bad or good decisions of the storyline?
No one ever gets the right amount of blame or the right amount of praise. It never works out that way, man.
Because I know a lot of people will sometimes argue, oh, it was an editorial mandate. Their hands were tied. It was, you know what fanboys say.
But every single instance is different. Every single one. And you can never tell. And so this is, I'm actually kind of grateful for the fact that you can never tell, because there's a point at which I think that I'm happy with the general fan base not knowing every detail of how the sausage is made. I think that's probably for the best, for everybody's enjoyment, but so that it's not, you know, so that the door is not so open that they can see the exact creative process every single step. I think it's better if they can just kind of watch the magic act happen without looking behind the curtain. But that said, you know, because of that separation, you know, they just guess that, you know, writers get credit for great ideas that editors had. Editors get blame for things that writers do or that artists do, or that, you know, an artist will be late with something and therefore, you know, he will blame the writer for something, and then it'll be, you know, and then he'll whip up the fans into a frenzy about making it look like the writer is responsible for the lateness of the book when it's the artist.
There's a few controversial storylines out there which got Well, fanboy's underwear in a bunch, but
And sometimes that's a writer coming in and saying this is what I want to do, and some, mm-hmm. and a lot of times it is editorial mandate a lot of times, but
especially for crossovers or event comics, I'm sure.
Yeah, or anything being produced by DC Comics right now, but that's all, every bit of that is editorial mandate. But yeah,
what about the corporate mandate, which is above the editorial mandate? How does that come into play?
It doesn't. At Marvel, I don't see it on a regular basis. You would think you would, but because Disney is known for not exactly being hands off, but I don't really see it there. I think that they kind of let Marvel be Marvel.
Well, ever since Pixar runs them now. The Pixar crew runs them now. So it's a kind of a different Disney now.
I mean, Disney owns tons of stuff that isn't Disney, so it's kind of like, you know, they're really hands on with the Disney properties, but I don't know how much they are with like all the other stuff they have that like nobody associates with Disney.
They're like,
I don't know. I think we'll know in about 10 years when they own everything.
Well, I'm sure Disney's like, you just keep the copyrighted characters warm for us so we can make movies.
That may be the case. I get the sense that, I don't know because I'm fairly removed, but I get the sense at DC that it's a lot more corporate hands down. I mean, I certainly know from years of experience there that, once those characters become movie characters, once Tim Burton takes Batman and turns it into something, Warner Brothers suddenly Batman is no longer a DC Comics character; he's a Warner Brothers character. And I remember, being on staff or being not on staff. I was actually off staff by this time, but I remember when the first time they changed Batman's costume in the comics to sort of reflect the movies a little bit more by taking the blue trunks off of him and, you know, making it a straight a black costume.
Right.
It would seem like it'd be the easiest, you know, most natural thing in the world. And Warner Brothers lost their mind. There were heads rolled. I mean, screaming, yelling. Right? How dare you do this without letting us know ahead of time what you're doing with this franchise character? And, the same with Superman and the same with Green Lantern to some degree, although I doubt it now that the movie was a colossal bomb. I don't think that Warner Brothers is terribly invested in protecting the Green Lantern franchise at this moment.
But I think the current writers for Green Lantern don't really give a flying hoot about what everybody else wants. They're just going to, we're going to keep making Green Lantern the way we're making Green Lantern. Like the Legion of Superheroes. We're going to keep making Legion of Superheroes the way we want to make Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah. Yeah.
One last question about print stuff before we go to our first break. Yeah. Now, if my sources are correct, I see that there's a couple of comics that you've penciled and colored.
Or at least dabbled with. What do we have there? They've done a little dabbling over the years. What do you got there?
According to Comic Book Database, mm-hmm. You're a penciler on Top Cow Holiday Special and the Who's Who of Legion of Superheroes in 1988. And then a colorist for Action Comics.
Yeah,
and Who's Who of DC Universe?
Yeah, let's see. I mean, but again, we're not talking about any sort of earth-shattering hidden talents. We're talking about quick down and dirty sketches. In the case of Who's Who in the Legion, it was just me doing a head of Superboy, which I blatantly traced off a Kurt Swan drawing. In the case of the coloring, it was that. We were in a blind panic. As if it were yesterday, 25 years ago, and as if it were yesterday, we were doing Action Comics Weekly. Green Lantern was the feature, the 8-page feature. Colorist comes in, brand new colorist, because the regular colorist, I think, was Richmond Lewis at the time. And our regular colorist was off for an issue out of town or something. So we'd given it to somebody new. Came in with 8 pages, all colored up, all ready to go. Had not read the story, interestingly enough. Hey, dear colorists, read the damn script. You know, read the story so you'll know what's going on. Because it was an entire 8-page fight scene inside a space station, which is lovely and a really good, well-drawn Mark Bright story. But what the colorist had failed to notice is that we made a big point of the fact that the entire space station was yellow. Every bit of it was yellow because this was back during the time when Green Lantern's ring did not work on yellow things. And so it comes in on a Friday at 11:30. It's got to leave house that afternoon to go to printer, and it's the weekly comic. So we can't screw up the deadline. And Dan Rassler and I are just sitting there staring at these beautifully colored pages where the it's all wrong. So we just at lunch, we break out the Dr. Martin's dyes and we sit there and we recolor the entire thing from start to finish in an hour. It made it easier, the fact that all the backgrounds were yellow, although different shades of yellow. So we gave, you know, had to give it a little bit of a variety, but that was a last minute panic job. So I've done that. I've done some, you know, done some production work here and there over the years, and inked, I guess they failed to mention, inked the cover to Hero Squared by Boom Studios.
It's not on here, but I do have a cover artist for Who's Who of Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah, that would be one of my little Superboy heads. Yes.
So. I imagine with Photoshop you could just now
put a tint layer on or something
and just change the hue.
Bucket
exactly.
Fill. Bucket
exactly.
Fill. Bucket
you,
fill.
You kids and your computers. I know.
Back in my day, we had to cut colored pieces of plastic. All right, we're going to take our first break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Thrillbent. This episode is brought to you by Hiveworks Comics, the new location for some of the internet's finest comics, such as Sister Claire, Go Get a Roomie, Namesake, Womp, Gilded Age, Four Tales, Red String, Misfile, Crazy Sunshine, Blaster Nation, and I Was Kidnapped by Lesbian Pirates from Outer Space. These prime cut webcomics are a fantastic read, plenty to satisfy your comic storytelling cravings all week. Check out Hiveworks Comics at thehiveworks.com. All right, and we're back. We're here with Mark Wade of Thrillbent.com. Now, before you started Thrillbent, you were essentially almost exclusively print comics. Is that right?
Yeah, exclusively. No qualifiers needed. Exclusively print comics, yeah.
So what made you decide to jump online and offer digital content?
It is turning out to be a much longer answer than I want it to be, I'll try to keep it brief, which is that there were several factors. The chief among them was the fact that the cost of print was so insane at that point. It had gotten to the point, this is 2 or 3 years ago, I was sort of looking at ways of, I was still at Boom Studios as the editor there, looking at ways of getting material out there that's not standard straight superhero comic stuff. And it became harder and harder to penetrate the market with stuff that wasn't spandex, because the retailers just didn't have the customer base for it. So the biggest leap that we had was that you look at the print runs of 4,000 and 5,000 copies, which for an indie comic then and now is still sadly a pretty decent number for, you know, an indie comic by newbies or, you know, or people who aren't established pros. Well, if you're doing a color comic and your print runs 4,000 or 5,000 copies, your print cost alone per copy is about $1 a copy. Now,
yeah, at least
if you're only getting $1.60 or so back from the distributor, once you sell your $4 comic to Diamond or whatever, then that doesn't leave very much left over to pay your writer, pay your artist, pay any of your creative costs, much less your overhead. It's not a workable model. And that was 3 years ago. And print costs have only gone up since then.
Perhaps. There's been a few things I've been hearing about as far as, I don't know, are regular, like, mainstream, I'll call them mainstream comics, are they offset printed, or are they starting to do digital printing now?
Well, they're still mostly offset printed. There is the idea that digital printing may, in fact, help break that level down towards, you know, hang on for a second. I'm getting huge feedback.
I'm going to disconnect everybody and then recall everyone back.
So let's take that from the top, which was you were asking me about offset versus digital printing.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what they were currently doing, because I've heard of a new Lightning Source, which actually used to be the printer for Amazon's Create Space until Amazon got their own printing thing. And then there was like a press release saying that you can get digital comics cheaper than ever now. Not digital, but like print comics cheaper than ever now. And the profit margin is a lot bigger. Cause I know, like, for a lot of us, web cartoonists, our printing selections are pretty limited right. if you want to do issues, which are really almost too expensive to really even do. Because it's like even for us, for most digital printing services, you're looking at least $2 per book.
Right, exactly, which becomes an insane, crazy upfront cost for you. That's, you know, the worst of it is it becomes an upfront cost for you unless you're doing it through Kickstarter or Indiegogo, mm-hmm. where you're getting some back-end money, you know, to put into it.
And even then, those are for, like, the bigger, like, 100-page books, which makes more sense.
Yeah. So this is not well, – my feeling was just basically that at that point, you know, periodical comics were not a viable business model unless you were – Marvel or DC or Dark Horse or somebody who was printing in such bulk that you can mm-hmm. get a decent discount on your printing. And that landscape may change in the days to come and mm-hmm. in the months to come. But for the time being, I'm still working under that premise, which is that I can't when I'm doing my indie stuff, when I'm doing my stuff that's not Marvel or DC or not superhero oriented, not for one of the big, like Diamond's big five publishers or whatever, mm-hmm. I got to think about digital first and then come back to print. That's part of the answer. The other part of the answer was that as I got into it and started working with incredibly talented guys like Balak, whose work I hope you know. You do know Balak's work. Yes? Say yes.
I am a brand new comic book reader, actually, as of the new 52.
He's not a comic book. He's a webcomic pioneer. I'll send you know what? How about the other guys? Have you heard of this guy? French?
There are like 35,000.
Crickets.
There's 35,000 webcomics out there. I read like 200 of them. I mean,
now this guy's the Orson Welles of digital comics development. And so I'll send you links when we're all done.
Okay.
But looking at his work, he produced a couple of quick pieces for his webpage called About Digital Comics, and his views of what digital comics should and shouldn't be and can and can't be, and his views of what you can do with the medium that people weren't doing. And that just, you know, we were thinking along the same lines already. I see this stuff, it blows my mind. This is about 3 years ago. And immediately that just started the wheels moving in my head. Like, there's things you can do with digital that you can't do with print, mm-hmm. that I think is amazing. And as a storyteller and as somebody who's been doing this for 25 years and is always looking for new and interesting ways to jazz up my job so I stay interested, this was very compelling to me.
Yeah, a lot of, like, you know, for a lot of us web cartoonists, a lot of what Scott McCloud had been talking about with Infinite Canvas has been something that a lot of people have been trying to do. But it's like, as of late and over the last several years, a lot more people are going to the, okay, I'm going to want to print and sell this at some point, so I got to go back to, like, the, you know, the page style. And so very few people are really experimenting with what web can do for comics. I mean, even still, I'm looking at several of the comics on Thrillbent. You got that sort of, you know, you click the next button and, you know, the panels will progress, dialogue balloons will pop in, slight changes will happen. You know, there it's a little bit more engaging, but it's all presented in such a way that I'm certain that it could be printed like a regular comic as well.
And it could. You some of the things that we do, you lose. Some of the things do, you know, you lose. But that said, you know, this was a shakedown cruise. I mean, remember, this was us leaping into Thrillbent 8 months ago or so with an idea of what we were doing, but let's figure it out as we go. I mean, that's a big part of what I'm proud of with Thrillbent is we get in there and we're very transparent about the fact that we're just building the barn. You know what? We're building a barn. Come watch us build a barn. Come help us build a barn. And when we're done, we'll look and see what we've got, and we will evaluate what worked and what didn't work, and then we'll move on to the next iteration. And in fact, we are, even as we speak, we've got a company in Brooklyn that's rebuilding our webpage from the ground up. And I gave them, now that we've been, you know, 6-7 months into Insufferable, the webcomic that I do there, mm-hmm. I've given them a laundry list of things I would like that viewer to be able to do, other than just your straight right left swipes and so forth. Okay. Yeah. The feeling was, I mean, you know, what's happened as we've gotten into it is that at first I was trying to design for both digital and print.
Okay.
And trying to serve both masters. And within a few weeks, I just sort of came to the realization that, oh my God, I can't serve both masters, and I would rather do one thing really well than do both half-assed. So let's concentrate on digital first. I know what I was saying. This will take some creative editing on your part. So a site in Brooklyn that's rebuilding our site from the ground up, because I went to them with a laundry list, a big wish list of things I want our viewer to be able to do rather than just the back and forth swiping and stuff. Can we go down? Can we use it as an infinite canvas? Can we do layering on it? Can we make it portable? Can we make it embeddable? All these things and more. And the answers to every question I had was yes, yes, and yes. So that's terrific. And so that will be rolling out in the next couple of months as well. And it'll be the next iteration, the next evolution of what we're doing there with the digital form.
Now, I do have
Are you gearing it more for the tablet reader?
Yeah, I not intentionally at first. We were trying at that point. I think at first we were trying to gear it more for the web in general, because I like the idea that as long as you've got access to the web, you're good for it. And I still want something that will always be easily readable for the web. And in fact, that was one of the things that we put down for these guys developing our new page too, which is that everything has to be scalable. Everything has to be fully scalable. Everything has to be adaptive technology, because I want you to be able to read this on any device. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware of the fact that a lot of the audience doesn't have tablets, but if I'm picking one delivery device to focus on, it would be the tablet, and then working backward from there.
Yeah, and even a lot of smartphones and such can still do the same thing. I mean, almost every single website is scalable as long as it's not the mobile version of a site, which sometimes mess you up.
I hate the mobile versions of most sites.
It's it's so boring. I don't know where anything is. Now, I have a couple of questions Okay, one question will lead up into the little bit more hotter question.
Sure.
The first question, you likened this site to building a barn.
Right.
Or maybe it's more like painting a fence. So I wanted to ask Mr. Finn, how did you get these other creatives to work with you on Thrillbent?
Yeah, well, it really is a combination of enthusiasm and a little bit of money. So, and when I say a little bit of money, we're paying on my collaborators, chump wages, but they're willing to work for chump wages because this is part of a bigger picture. This is part of we're trying to revolutionize. We're trying to do something that nobody else is doing before. There's value in that.
Now, that's the million-dollar question here.
Yeah,
you're not on Thrillbent. You're not selling anything, and there's no ads anywhere. How is this a good idea?
I'll tell you. I mean, here's the thing. You have to be willing to work for free for a while. You have to be willing to be able to put your material out there and worry less about the revenue stream at first and more about awareness and market penetration and all those other fancy buzzwords. But basically, you have to worry most about getting the word out there that what you're doing is worth doing and worth looking at. So, we could have built in a paywall model right off the bat, but
that wouldn't have worked.
It wouldn't have worked. I'm a huge, huge, huge believer in giving it away for free whenever you can and however you can.
Right.
And letting the market dictate what they're willing to pay for it.
Well, that's why I was like, I look at it, I'm like, you're like big names, and just like you don't even have Google Ads. Or even Project Wonderful, which was originated for webcomic sites. And it's like, I know a lot of people that'd be willing to fork over money just to have a little link to their comic somewhere on your site. So it's like, it's hard for me to think of when professionals, professional print creatives, talk about webcomics with almost a disdain. How can they possibly make money?
You don't have to use the word almost. I think disdain is a fair assumption. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, they can't possibly make money. Well, there's a lot more to it. They're not asking the right questions. And the part of it, especially for the top tier web cartoonists, a lot of how they make their money are through the site ads.
Sure. I know. I understand that fully. This is the idea was, let's first get up there with as much material as we can. Let's get a run of material out there that proves that we are going to be here every week that proves that we're not dabbling, mm-hmm. that we're not dilettantes coming into play, and then we're going to take up our ball and go home. Let's do that first. Let's concentrate on getting the material out there, which is why we were offering downloads of our own stuff off the site for free while we were putting up our own torrents, why we were doing all the file sharing and mm-hmm. so forth, because frankly, that stuff's going to get file shared anyway. So why not be in control of it? Why not provide file sharers the files that they're going to put up there anyway? Because at least that way you get to control the quality. You get to have some say over, you know, over what it looks like. Mm-hmm. And that way I get to put in a page at the back of every installment that says, hey, if you want more free comics, come to thrillbent.com. And sure enough, that's much better for us than just the early pirated versions that were being file shared, which were, you know, nice to get the word out there, but because the pages themselves don't have credits built into them mm-hmm. or copyright notices or anything like that, I wanted the word Thrillbent doesn't appear in the actual comics page. So, mm-hmm. you know, when I was seeing the early pirated versions, I was like, well, this is awesome. And I think this is great that people care enough to circulate this stuff, but let me give them something to circulate. So that way they can at least know where to go for more. I kind of lost track of the question now. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I got another point here. And I think it's that what you're doing is going to be a whole lot easier when you already, well, first have money and two, are somebody.
Yeah.
But
here's the thing. And this is why this is such an important mission for me. And this is why I'm so dedicated to this, the Thrillbent paradigm. Or whatever comes out of it, or whatever mm-hmm. the next guy invents on top of us that is better than what we do, is this idea that I'm trying to prove. I'm with you. I get frustrated at the disdain that print comics guys have for webcomics. This sort of hand waving, oh, nobody makes any money doing webcomics, and it's just a fool's game and stuff. And I'm thinking, the guys who are making money are making really good money. It's not easy. And it's hard work, and it's not all about you can't just write a story and then send it off into the ether and get a check. You got to work hard at social media. You got to work hard at marketing. You got to work hard at all these aspects
of it. It's a lot of do it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, so it doesn't mean, it means that the nature of your job as a creator has changed, that it's no longer a matter of just sitting in your garret and penciling pages. And that's all you get. That in return means that you get a good revenue, and that's all you have to do. And I'm sorry, but that's the reality of it is that, yeah, you may have to learn how to market. You may have to learn how to use social media to your advantage. You may have to learn a bunch of other things about your job that you didn't know before if you're a creator. But guess what? That's the world we're entering into. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted my goal with Thrillbent is to prove beyond every shadow of a doubt that if your material is good, and if you market it correctly, and if you are, if you put your passion behind getting the word out there, and if it's good, let me say that six more times, if the material's good, that's a huge part of it. But that it's possible to do it and not lose your shirt. It's possible to be, the first rule of all new media is always nobody gets rich, but everybody gets paid. That's what we want to try to – that's all we're trying to build out here. If I can do Thrillbent and at the end of the day not lose money, I consider that a victory, because we're trying to build a platform that other people can build on top of.
That's the dream of a lot of web cartoonists. I just want to break even.
Right. I don't need to have three Cadillacs in my garage. I don't need to have, a jet ski – in my heated underground pool. I just need to be able to put food on the table. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't promise anybody that they're going to get rich off Thrillbent. In fact, I told my other creators, I said, look, at the end of the day, we may just break even. And we're only breaking even because we are people with market awareness. Now, we were people who have sort of names in the industry, and right. we can, we have a certain fan base that we can already cater to, that we know will buy print editions and we'll buy apps and whatever. So we can count on that. But at least, like I said, I'm just trying to prove that it can be done, and it can, and the more of us that there are at Thrillbent doing it, and not losing our shirts, and, you know, hopefully at some point in the next couple of years, making a decent living doing it, then it just becomes, I hope it becomes easier for everybody, whether you're brand new or whether you're an established pro, to get out there and it's a viable business model. It's a viable medium. It's in fact, in some ways, it's a far more viable medium than periodical print comics is. So again, I'm kind of wound up, but you see what I'm saying. This is
oh, yeah.
This is what it's about to me. I don't give a damn about making any money off of it. I would like to make some money off of it, but that's not the goal. The goal is to prove that it's worthwhile.
One of us.
Yeah, seriously. And the great thing I've learned about webcomics, guys, and my big takeaway of talking to a lot of guys in the last year or so at conventions and, you know, on just phone calls and emails and stuff, is that, and I'm overgeneralizing, but I find it amazing that the divide between webcomics and print comics is so enormously huge that people don't realize it. Like, most print comics guys don't have the slightest idea of what web comics are out there or which ones are actually making money or which ones are actually a success. And conversely, most web comics guys they're not really engaged in the print comics world that much. So to them, you know, a Brian K. Vaughan and a, you know, Joe Schmedley are about the same. They don't understand, they don't get the difference. They're just, you know, they're guys doing comics. I think that what's cool about that, though, and this is what I love about webcomics, the webcomics community, is that without fail so far, everybody's been generous. Everybody's been sharing. Everybody's been amenable to figuring out new ways of doing things and sharing information. And there's not as much of a sense of competition in the webcomics community. Because you're not, unlike the print comics community, you're not fighting for the same 100,000 customers.
You're not fighting for shelf space and
exactly
the price is right.
You're not jockeying for position in the diamond catalog. You're not trying to beat your competition. What you're trying to do in the webcomics community is you realize that your potential audience is 6 billion people. There's room for all of us. So that's been amazing and that's been awesome. It's just being able to share ideas back and forth and. Because I've said this before, but I'm completely and utterly convinced. I was convinced of this 2 years ago. I was convinced that on the aggregate, we as creative people, had figured out everything that needs to be figured out about webcomics. The trick then was just to be able to talk to each other and share that information, because you figured out something that I haven't figured out, and I figured out something that the next guy hasn't figured out. And let's put those thoughts together. There's not a sense of proprietorship here.
Websites have a paywall. We're not going to mention a name, but some sites have a paywall for particular tips and tricks for webcomics.
Right. And I get that. And I said it wasn't a generalization. There's always going to be guys out there who are a little, and you know what? I get that too. I get that. Cause capitalism is based on the philosophy that that your ideas and your special things that you do have value and are worth protecting. And I think I said this at my infamous, you know, Hindenburg-like keynote speech at Baltimore a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
That a lot of this is – a lot of these conversations we're having about the propriety of your ideas or my ideas, or the, you know, collaborating or not collaborating, or the fear of webcomics in general. A lot of those conversations, I think, are coming out of the fact that we are in the worst economic crisis we've been since the Great Depression. And that the fear that stokes among people is stronger than it would have been 10 or 15 years ago. The sense that, you know, as markets dry up, as paychecks shrink, as it makes it hard, as insurance prices grow and, you know, cost of living skyrockets and so forth, people get more and more nervous about, and justifiably so, people get more and more nervous about, how am I going to put bread on the table? How am I going to provide for my kids? How am I going to be able to do this? Mm-hmm. And so everybody sort of gets more precious about what they can do, and very more protective about what they can do, and more worried about how to monetize what they do.
Right.
And it's a natural instinct, and I get that totally. But what I'm trying to say is that that's the worst thing you can do in a situation like that. We need to be able to work together and throw ideas back and forth and build on each other's resources and make this work. The whole – I'm preaching to the choir here. I know because you guys know this. But the entire economic model of American society and American capitalism is changing. It's changing radically in the last 10 years. We're becoming a society where the commerce is sharing, where the commerce is not nickels and dimes, where the commerce is not defined so much by dollars and cents, but it's defined more by social networking, by sharing. And when I say sharing, I don't mean, you know, here, take a lick of my ice cream cone. I mean more that sense of, look at this cool thing that I'm looking at. You should be looking at it too. That, you know, using the fan base and using your audience to be part of the promotion process and inviting them in and letting them choose to, if they want to choose to join you in this crusade to get the material out. That's the new economy. That's absolutely the new economy. And it, you know.
Yeah, it's the crazy thing, like, because people, I mean, you always hear people complain about ads. I mean, I know when I put ads on my site, I got, you know, a handful of letters saying, like, you should go kill yourself because people are that angry about ads. But it's like, we've created, like, a system where people can make money just by you looking at their thing. And, like, yeah. That's pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of times for us, they're ads for, like, more comics, usually. Yeah. And it's like, yeah. I found a lot of comics doing that. I mean, it's like, and also what you were saying about sharing. I mean, you know, we're in our fifth anniversary of the Webcomic Beacon here, and we've been nothing but sharing and trying to help creatives in webcomics for the past 5 years. So I totally get that.
Yeah. This is what it's about. And to say this to a room full of artists and cartoonists and writers who have been in print comics all their careers and this is all they know is, you know, that it's daunting to say that to these people because they don't get it. This is not the model, the economic model upon which they built their careers. But
blasphemy.
But you know what? Join the 21st century. Come to the table. This is a good thing. The thing that makes me it's a bit of a tangent here, but not really. I mean, the thing that makes me most insane about people whining that creators whining that their comics are being pirated online and therefore their comics aren't selling because they're being pirated online and they're losing sales and it's destroying the medium and stuff. And the thing that makes me the most insane about that claim is that, first off, it's not true. And second, you know, there's still no correlation between the two. And secondly, here's my feeling. If your comics are being pirated around the world, before you go to your knee-jerk reaction of how do I make money off of that, perhaps you should take a moment, just a moment, to bask in the excitement of the fact that as a creator and as a communicator and as an artist, your work is being coveted and admired and shared and expressed and talked about all over the world. And I guarantee that if I were giving the same speech at the poetry convention down the street, no one would care, you know, because it's not like that. It's like there's a raging, you know, underground for pirated poetry at this moment in human history. Be excited about that. Find a way to realize that that is part of the model. And like I said, with Thrillbent, you know, what we did is rather than whine and scream about it and try to figure out, you know, copy protection nonsense and shit, you know, we just embraced it and figured, okay, well, let's use this to our advantage. Let's use this to get the word out. There you go.
I just have one last question, and I don't know if anybody else here has another question, but I do have one more question.
Sure.
With looking at Thrillbent and seeing what you've built already, I'm kind of curious about the future. If they're, maybe others that might be interested in getting in on this, perhaps maybe on their own dime, or maybe if you might be looking at unknowns or recruiting other people as well. Are there any sort of like ideas like that in mind yet? Or do you still want to keep this in?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, we have been building content behind the scenes for some time now with the idea, because the idea is I really want to roll it by the time we get to January, February. I really would like to roll it out with something new every day. That's my big dream, is just to get at least one new strip up every day. So there's always a reason every day for you to come back and visit the site for something. At this point, I'm sort of handpicking the guys I'm working with, but as we start to build and expand mm-hmm. in, you know, the spring of next year, we'll be doing more of an open call to get more material in from people I haven't heard from. And then, you know, some of the things that will help that process too is, and this is something that we touched upon a minute ago, but I want to circle back to it so we don't leave it conspicuously out of the conversation, which is monetization in general. You know, we can't keep going this way forever, obviously, because we're just burning money. But the thing I like about the experimental nature of Thrillbin, as I've said to other collaborators and other creators, is I've got a couple of ideas for monetizing what we're doing. If you've got ideas to monetize what you're doing that aren't what I'm doing, then feel free. I mean, let's play around with it. The thing I like about having two or three or four or five different strips up is that I might decide that my best shot at monetization is, you know, an advanced subscription model where for 99 cents, you can get next month's for free, you know, next month's in advance. Or you may think that your best model is, pay as you go or pay what you will, or, you know, pay us what you think it's worth. And the other guy might, you know, somebody else might think that their best model might be, you know, downloadable PDFs. Whatever. I mean, let's play around with all those things and see what works and mm-hmm. see what works and what doesn't work. We've got a couple of things in mind right now. Just we're going to roll out an app in the next few weeks that will have the material on it as well as bonus content that you're not getting for free on the web. Not that we're holding out, but I mean, you know, behind the scenes stuff, back matter stuff mm-hmm. that make it worthwhile. If you're a big fan, you'll always be able to read Insufferable for free on the web. We're not going to put up a paywall anytime soon. That's not the goal. It's just, you'll always be able to read it for free on the web. But mm-hmm. if we can build in an added value that is worth 99 cents a month for you or whatever to download on your app, then great. And we'll try that. And that may not work, but we'll try it. There's a bunch of different things we can try. And so as we cast around and look for other people and other creators to be part of Thrillbent, that's part of the understanding, which is that, look, I don't care how you make your money. If you can kick us back, you know, 10 or 15% of what you make off the site for maintenance, that's swell. We would appreciate that, but we don't want a piece of, you know, we're not looking for blanket ownership of your stuff. It's still a communal collaboration, and we'll feed off each other's ideas. And the more mm-hmm. material we have up there, the more likely we are to have eyes on the page. So that said, yeah, we are going to be casting out for new material from new guys and or people I don't have a personal relationship with. We'll do that after the first of the year. I mean, right now we're just trying to get it up and running where we can, you know, feel like we got a good structure.
Well, another good idea that I know a lot of people do, I mean, it's like I noticed you already have, PDF downloads. Yeah. Even selling high-res PDF downloads so people can look at – I mean, the way that you have your comic structured already, I mean, it's like high-res full screen on someone's monitor could look – a lot of people are willing
– that's part of it. And the other thing – that's one of the things that we're actually building. The other thing is, I mean – frankly, I mean, Comixology came to us a couple of months ago and said, look, we know how many copies of Incorruptible and Irredeemable and Daredevil and all these other things that you do. We know what these numbers are on Comixology, and we have every confidence that Insufferable would do really well there too. Would you be interested? And I said, as long as it's a completely non-competitive or rather non-exclusive relationship, then I see no reason not to do it. It's funny. I have an interesting relationship with Comixology in that I love the guys. I love David. I love John. I love Chip Mosier. I love the guys working there. They've always been great to me. Mm-hmm. I love that they've managed to carve out this place for themselves in the market. I don't agree on a philosophical level with everything they do as a company, not on an ethical level. I just mean on a philosophical level about how they present the material mm-hmm. or the guided panel view and stuff. I have on a creative level, we've had honest discussions about how I'm not on a personal level. I'm not thrilled about some of that stuff, but it doesn't mean I don't like those guys. And it doesn't mean that I'm not willing to say, all right, well, look, if you want to, if you want us to bundle, say, 4 weeks worth of Insufferable at a time under a new frontis piece with some new back matter, you know, we'll put it through Comixology. And at the same time, we can also offer it as a high res download off our site, or we can offer it through other vendors as well. And we'll see. The nice thing about the Comixology deal is that that will at least help us amortize our costs. That even if it's not huge money, any revenue that they bring in that is, again, not exclusive because it's only another revenue stream, it doesn't mean that we can't do whatever else we want to do to build revenue.
Mm-hmm. And it's more eyes that are elsewhere, too, that are hopefully getting to know, hey, what's this? You know, and they check it out.
Exactly. It's a different market for selling our books to a market that we're not necessarily reaching right now. So I'm fine with that. I think that that's, and what we've said to other creators at Thrillbent is, if you want to be part of that, feel free. If you are not obligated to be part of that, but if you would like to, and we get in there and we find that it works well for us, then we'll help walk you through it so you can do it easily too. I'm not averse to that. I mean, it's not necessarily my preferred method of selling these comics digitally, because I still like the idea of ownership. I like the idea that if you download something, you have the file and it's not hosted on somebody else's server.
Right.
You know, but that said, you know, let me just make it clear. I mean, there will always be, as long as anything we offer through Comixology, we will, or any other vendor like that, we will always also make sure that it's available for you to purchase at the same price someplace else where you can actually have the file. Mm-hmm. But Comixology has no problem with that. They just want to be, they want to be in the mix. So great. Let's see what revenue that brings in. If that does nothing but pay our creative costs, so we break even and nothing better, then hell, it's absolutely worth doing just for that, because then the rest of the revenue we make off that comic is, you know, is just up from there.
Excellent. And, you know, I don't know if I'd do too much to Thrillbent if it were my idea. So I'm really liking pretty much everything that you've been saying about it, and really excited for the future for it.
And what do you see? When you see the rollout of what we're getting, you know, done with the redesign of the page in the next couple of months, and the way the viewer is going to work, what we're doing right now is going to look like the Flintstones. let me underscore this as well. Let me make sure that we are all on the same page about this. That all of that said, my basic definition of what a webcomic is stays the same, which is that it doesn't have music, it doesn't have sound effects, it doesn't have voices, it doesn't have artificial animation, it doesn't anything that compromises the reader's ability to control the flow of the story or the pace at which he absorbs the information is, as far as I'm concerned, off the table. No matter what you do with that viewer, no matter what interesting, funky storytelling tricks you can come up with, my feeling is it's still purely comics, as long as you, the reader, get to control when you turn the page, when you read the balloon, that's the intimacy of comics. Otherwise it's just bad animation and you're just viewing it. You're not in it. You're watching it happen.
I totally know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, that's all the questions I have. Kelly, Mark, did you have any questions left?
Oh, man. Like I was saying before, like there were things I was thinking, like, while you were talking, but eventually you answered them, so.
I have a question that's backing way up, though.
Okay.
Back in the day, I was a big fan of Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah, okay. All right.
And I would buy these sometime in the 80s all the way up to that's previous incarnation where being youth was like outlawed or something.
Right. I can't. Right.
So this series has been changed and changed and changed and changed and changed. I think they're on their sixth incarnation now.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's more than that.
That's a whole nother story. But as a writer, I'm just wondering, how would you approach something like the Legion, where there's like 40 different characters. I've
done it. I mean, I've done two runs on the Legion, and the one I was proudest of is the one that you mentioned a second ago, was the iteration of, we sort of wiped the slate clean and said, look, here's the deal. Legion they are no longer agents of order in a world of chaos. They are instead agents of chaos in a world of order. They're kids who are brought up in a world that is so structured and so adult oriented and so full of control and observation and sterility that they're just sick of it. So that was the iteration that I launched with Barry Kitson, I guess, in 2004. And we ran with that for about 5 or 6 years, but the fan reaction was not good to it. The fan reaction, the reader reaction was great. People who hadn't read Legion were like, this is awesome. We love this. Do more of this. And that's great, because those are the people I was writing for. And that's coming from me, who is the biggest Legion fan in the world. And I love the Legion more than anything short of Superman, but the Legion fans, you know, they hated what we were doing because it wasn't exactly like what they read when they were kids. And what I tried to say over and over again, and I'll believe this until I die, is that the problem that Legion has run into over the years as a franchise is that it's been rebooted and reimagined, and you know, the continuity of it has been messed with so many times over the years, mm-hmm. that even if you write a perfectly accessible Legion story there's no way in the world you would need any prior information to join. If you write the most new reader friendly Legion story in the world, most people will still stay away from it in droves, because the rep on that book, the mm-hmm. reputation of the Legion as a franchise, is that you have to have a degree in Legionology just to be able to read the damn comic.
It is the most canceled comic series of all time, I heard.
No. In fact, j'accuse. No. In fact, Aquaman, of all the DC franchises.
Oh, I could see that.
Aquaman is currently on its eighth incarnation. Hawkman was up to its sixth incarnation or whatever, and it at this point, maybe it's seventh, but Aquaman, this is volume 8 of Aquaman that we're looking at now. Whereas with Legion, we're only on volume 7. So,
well, it got canceled again. The DC one is canceled.
What, where they went back to the 70s version?
The Legion Lost one, right? The offshoot book. Yeah.
I think both of them.
No, I think Legion is still, I think Legion Superheroes is still a going franchise.
I like what you did with Brainiac.
Thanks.
He was really interesting. He was more interesting than ever.
I love that character. I love all those characters, but I especially love Brainiac 5. I think that the idea of a super genius who is not necessarily a snotty, aloof, emotionless prick is kind of interesting, and because that there's some shading to that. So anyway, that's the answer to the question. That's how it approaches. I would just say, look, here's my shot across the bow to let you know that you are welcome here, even if you've never read Legion before, because we are starting fresh from scratch and treating it as if the book has been canceled for 20 years and we're reviving a franchise from the 80s that nobody's heard of since. That was my approach. And it worked for about 6 months. The sales on it were actually really good. The sales were climbing. And then DC undercut me by deciding that Geoff Johns and Brad Meltzer were doing their Legion over in Justice League of America, and it was the old Legion, and so what we were doing was not the real Legion, and they did all this without telling us. And so I know by about issue 6 or 7, we realized that the word got out among fans and among retailers that what we were doing was somehow not, it was like an Elseworlds Legion or something. We were, you know, we didn't know it. We didn't write it like that.
Ultimates Legion.
Yeah. And so once you brand it in the marketplace as something that is not the real Legion or the real Superman or the real Spider-Man or whatever, then there's no interest. All right. I think that kind of wraps us up, if that's good.
It does. It does. Mm-hmm. And I do want to quickly mention that there also on the Webcast Beacon Network, we have a comic book review show called First Issue, where we review first issues of comics. And I did pick up a Legion of Superheroes number 1 by Mark Waid, which we'll eventually get to.
Okay. All right. Good. Okay.
And with that, with this particular episode, it is a prize episode. So one of the prize offerings is that we're offering an advertising spot on the next issue episode of First Issue, as well as the option to give us a particular comic that we have to review, and that people can submit their own comic for that. And that we need a keyword to be emailed to us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com. Mark, give us a keyword that they should email us.
Brainiac5.
There we go. Email Brainiac5 to webcomicbeacon@gmail.com.
Mark, that would have been my choice, too. Great marks think alike.
Mark, I thank you very much for coming on this show and taking some time out of your day to talk to us about your history. And Thrillbent, really excited for this. I know you got a family emergency online, so we'll let you get to that.
All right, great. Thanks so much, guys. And anything I can do to help in the future, just let me know.
It sounds
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Yes. Once again, Mark Wade from Thrillbent.com. Thank you once again. Good luck.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
I'm really surprised at how much a webcomicer that Mark Wade is. It's like, dude, somebody gets it. And he's been in the print comic industry for like 25 years.
The speech that he gave, that talk that he gave, is very much akin to what Bill Watterson gave to the strip cartoonists.
Really?
It was kind of
hey, you know, things are changing.
Well, Dave Kellett did that like speech that was as a response to like Watterson's a few years ago. That it's on YouTube. I think it's called like Freeing Comics or something. But it was all pretty similar to that. I keep hearing an echo of my voice, so I'm talking weird.
That's Skype.
Yeah, and. Let's see here. Is do we ever find out if the person that does the Sunday comic, the newspaper comic Fraz, is really Bill Watterson?
It's not him. It's somebody else. It just has his style.
I had like a hope that maybe he's come back.
It's a different guy, but you wouldn't know it. It really looks like his style. Artist said that he wanted to ape Watterson's style, like Fraz is a grown up Calvin.
Mm-hmm. His spiritual sequel,
I guess.
I don't know. It still could possibly. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised, because apparently there was also this guy that once went looking for him. Like there was like this audio thing that I had downloaded. He actually got an interview with his mom, and apparently they didn't even have pictures of Bill. They claimed they didn't have pictures of Bill around the house, and the picture that was there was of Bill's brother. It's almost like he doesn't even exist. It's like the only way that Bill Watterson could come back is if he did come back and do something different. Completely different. I mean, there's too much hype. He couldn't come back and do Calvin and Hobbes.
I saw a Q&A with him somewhere online where he said he was aware of webcomics but wasn't really interested.
Well, that's too
bad. He appreciated the works that were out there, but he wasn't interested in doing it.
I mean, you know, it's like I know he really fought against doing like all the licensing stuff. But it could have been so easy, because it's like he didn't really want the product cheapened. And a lot of times back then, you know, what cheapened the comics were just basically reprinting the comics. Now, I would have loved a whole calendar of Calvin and Hobbes.
Coffee mug.
No dialogue. You don't need dialogue. You just need Calvin and Hobbes doing something in the woods, in that watercolor, you know, just something that you would just put in a frame anyway, you know? That's great. I would love stuff like that. You don't need the comics. You don't need the dialogue. Just a scene of Calvin and Hobbes doing what they do. And that would have not cheapened it at all. And, you know, it would have made money too. I mean, let's be honest.
I think his issue was that, like, if he signed it over for like licensing like that, then like it would kind of be out of his hands, and it would just be like whatever the powers that be wanted to do. It wouldn't be like, you know, he couldn't say like just do this one thing. It would be like fair game for them to make all the stuffed animals and TV shows. Like,
I see
that they wanted.
The problem with that is that, you know, it's like as what Mark was saying on the show. You know, he talked to Comixology. you worked out a deal with them. You know, there's no such thing as a status quo contract. You always have the ability to negotiate. It's just whether or not that they want to accept your terms. And if they don't, well, too bad. Then you don't do it.
If you read all the, you know, like the 10th anniversary Calvin and Hobbes and stuff like that, it's got I keep hearing my echo. Yeah, it's just kind of like outlines the fight that he went through to get like everything he, you know, like the size of the comics and just like, I feel like when it came to like merchandise, like he was kind of sick of fighting. Like,
yeah. Yeah, I'd really love that. It was so ballsy to say, you know what, I'm going to make a big size. I don't care if I get dropped by some people.
Well, like after he had those, you know, those huge fights with like publishers and that about, you know, comic sizes and stuff, like a bunch of people like in the industry turned on him because they were saying like, oh, you know, he's so full of himself. He's like taking space away from other people. And then he was like so tired of just this like endless fight that when he finally got his way, like he ended up like a year later going on hiatus for a while because he was just like, you know, like couldn't, he was done. And then the other artists were like, oh, like what's this guy's like, you know, arrogance that he's trying to like shake up the way things work and take space away from us. And then he's going to go off on vacation. It was just like not an easy battle for him.
Yeah. And not like any other newspaper cartoonist of the syndicate actually does take a hiatus. And actually it's in their contract. They have a right to take a sabbatical.
Well, they don't get health insurance or anything like that.
They still get paid. They get at least 1 6-month paid sabbatical. That's what it was. That's what I believe that's what he even said.
For the whole contract?
Well, yeah, it's part of being of the syndicate. It's called a sabbatical. It's like so that you get some time away, you know, recharge your creative juices. I remember a lot of different newspaper comics did that because I know that the newspapers still had to pay for those reruns. So yeah. I was pretty sure that it was a paid sabbatical.
Well, some people like, what's his name? The guy just Garfield, Jim Davis. Yeah. Like he hasn't written or drawn a Garfield comic since like 1987 or something. Like he's just got a stable of people who does it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. It's like, some people criticize him for that. But on the other hand, other people have been like, well, it's kind of like being Walt Disney. Like, you know, he wasn't drawing all the Mickeys and that. He was just sort of like, he created a property and made it work for him.
That makes sense. I still think the best Garfield was Garfield and Friends. Because it made more sense. I don't know why. Oh, okay. All right. I think we got to take our final break. And when we come back, more information on prizes and how you can win them.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network. Follow us on Twitter at Webcomic Beacon. Email us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com. Or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We're also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcasts and video show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network. Covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
So, we have this thing going on. It's the 5th anniversary of the Webcomic Beacon. And we're giving away, I'm giving them stuff away. And people just need to email us the keywords from certain episodes. And apparently some people download the episodes but don't listen to them. So they're all like a backlog of Webcomic Beacons somewhere. So by the time you hear this, you are a loser. You didn't get an email. Yes. But for those that are listening, we have a few things that you can win with some deadlines coming up. There's already two prizes that passed their deadline. And I have to say, because not a lot of people sent anything in, basically everybody that sent something in wins, or won, I should say. But coming up on December 15th, there is a deadline for two different prizes. One, listen to the interview of the Double Clicks and Molly Lewis for the prize keyword in that episode. Two people will win both the Double Clicks Chainmail and Cella album, and Molly Lewis's album, I Made You a CD, But I Eated It. So that's wow. two prizes. And also there is, listen to the print-on-demand options for Cartoonists episode, where we have the Webcomic Beacon newscasts, Marie Terry, and also sponsor of the show, not this particular episode, but sponsor of several other Webcomic Beacon episodes, Sean Granger of KingTractorPress.com. You can win his complete three graphic novels set, Family Bones 1 and 2, which I really like Family Bones, and Volume 1 and 2 are basically the whole story, and then Innocent Volume 1. Now, these are graphic novels. They're great read. I haven't read Innocent yet, but Family Bones is a great read. And so two people will also be able to win all three of those. All you have to do is listen to that episode, Print on Demand Options for Cartoonists, for the prize keyword. And same thing for the double clicks of Molly Lewis. Email that. You can be in the same email address. Email that to webcomicbeacon@gmail.com. Also, for this particular episode, if you email the prize keyword Brainiac5 to webcomicbeacon@gmail.com, the prize for this episode is a free first issue video advertisement slot and or choice of comic book for us to review. Now, we review issues, typically number ones, but I'm going to say any issue that we can reasonably attain. So it can't be like a $30 rare comic or more, you know, something like that. We got to be able to find it, or if you have it. And also, at your own risk, you can also send us your comic book for review. Be warned, if we think it fails, we will say so. Winning the prize does not automatically make us say it's going to be a succeeding comic. And so email that to us. And the deadline for this episode, for the first issue advertisement slot, is going to be, I think, December 29th.
Oh.
And next week, we are going to be recording our fifth anniversary episode. We're going to be recording it on the 16th, which means it should be out on the 19th or 20th. I'm going to have an interview with Nicole, who's Hello the Future. We've had her on for our third year anniversary. So I'm going to get an interview with her combined in, and there's going to be a CD of hers that somebody can win, as well as I'm going to get an interview of Matt Scherer, who does the comic Badly Drawn Kitties, who was the first person who was interviewed on the Webcomic Beacon, episode 3, in fact. And then we're going to I think we're going to get Tanya back on the show to talk to her about what the hell has she been doing in the past, ever since she left us. but I know for that episode, I'm going to have a couple of prizes for that as well. There's going to be the prize keyword as well. That'll be one chance. But if you want an extra chance,
you send a
good comment or question of like any of the hosts here or of the Webcomic Beacon, so that can be an extra chance. And the prizes are going to be a cartoony color headshot of you for your online avatar or profile picture drawn by Diana Nock, who is the current artist for the Becky Beacons around the site. She does all the line work. And also Poorcraft, The Funny Book Fundamentals of Living Well on Less. This is a graphic novel, basically for what I just said, the fundamentals for living well on less, written by Spike Trotman, who does Templar Arizona and also did organized the Smut Peddler comic book, graphic novel collective anthology, as it is. And it was drawn also by Diana Nack. So that's a theme. And so that is only one person will be winning that. And so get on that now, because I want to give these things away. And with how few people have been actually emailing me, get off your butt, because there's a good chance that you will win.
Be a winner.
Hot dog. Oh, boy. This has been a great episode. We had Mark Wade on. He got a lot of information. Hopefully this will get like a signal boost for like a whole lot of people to win prizes and learn about our fifth anniversary special.
Oh, gee, you get some swag.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Get free stuff. Oh, gee. Could be a winner instead of a loser.
And, let's see. And of course, this particular episode is brought to you by Hiveworks Comic Collective at thehiveworks.com. Great webcomics there, such as Go Get a Roomie, Sister Claire, Namesake, Misfile, Red String, Crazy Sunshine, I Was Kidnapped by Lesbian Pirates from Outer Space, Blaster Nation, Four Tales, Gilded Age, Spinneret is over here now, and another one called Womp, which I just saw got added. And Hiveworks is also partnered with Pixie Tricks Comics, which does Menage a Trois, Magic Chicks, Eerie Cuties, and Fragile. We had Shuri on the show once before. I want to get her on again. She was a nice guest. And so, go ahead and check it out. A lot of great comics over there. And, of course, they are also presently our host. So thank you for having us, and thank you for sponsoring this episode. If you want more information on sponsoring episodes, you can go to webcastbeacon.com/advertise for more information.
Head on over, folks. Gee whiz.
And that's the end of this episode, and next week is going to be the fifth anniversary special. I have no idea what we're going to be doing for that, except we're at least going to have Tanya on and everything that I mentioned there. If anybody has any ideas, be sure to email us, especially if you have a question or comment and want to get in with an extra chance to win. Email webcomicbeacon@gmail.com for more. Kelly, Mark? Mm-hmm. Thank you for being here once again. I've been Fess of ArgerComic.com.
Then Kelly Turnbull of ManlyGuys.com.
And this is Mark of AutumnLake.com.